All right. So start with a disclaimer. That's always useful to lower your expectations. Is this a pointer? No. All right. Guess not. It's only with a broad stretch of imagination that you would be able to describe me as an expert on community resilience. I haven't worked in the area. I'm relatively new to modeling, although I've catalyzed a lot of efforts in that direction. So you can check your email now if you're online or not off. It does work.
Okay.
This thing. This? Which?
Right there.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, good. Okay. So I do claim some expertise in the area of social epidemiology. As you can see, the cartoon says, and it was so typically brilliant of you to have invited a social epidemiologist, with a little editorial revision on my part. And I think it does have something to say about community resilience. The first thing I want to do is say that this notion of the impact of communities on health, and I'm talking about health because I'm an epidemiologist, and that's what I think about, The notion that community structure and function, organization, and capabilities have something to do with health is something that's been around for a while. It's become very popular, but it's been hampered by the lack, I think, of a properly constituted modeling approach. And so I'm very excited about this activity and other activities that are trying to move forward on that. Certainly there has been some work in the area. It hasn't touched epidemiology much, except in the area of transmission dynamics of infectious disease. So there is lots of interest in neighborhood, community, and spatial aspects of health. Now, to some of you, that wouldn't seem to be a surprise. After all, we know that if you live next to a toxic dump, which is spatially distributed, you're likely to be sicker. But there's a whole set of studies that have developed over the last 30 years, really a reinstitution of the Chicago School of Sociology, but now is represented in epidemiology and sociology, that community factors have something to do with health. So this is a study that we published 21 years ago, in which we had a group of people, 7,000 people, and some of them lived in the federally designated poverty area of Alameda County in Northern California, and others didn't live in the poverty area. And you can see that those in the poverty area were living in an area that was, by all accounts, far worse off. When we looked at the survival experience over the next 9 years, the people in the poverty area had a death rate which was 56% higher. Again, not so surprising. But when we did the kitchen sink kind of regression modeling, where we threw in every piece of information we knew about them as individuals, and we knew a lot. This was a oversaturated model with 22 covariates in it. I would never do that again. I probably couldn't get it published. This was basically unbudged. Still a 50% increased risk of death. So there seemed to be some unmeasured characteristics of either the individuals in these poverty areas, or more likely about the areas in which they lived, which was associated with increased risk. Now, there's been an explosion of interest in this area. There are probably 500 studies or more in the epidemiologic literature, which in one way or another, probably using better methods and better measures, reproduce this finding that where you live matters, as in politics, location, and house sales, location, location, location. So now what characterizes most of these studies is that they view characteristics which are associated with increased risk in the community. Living in one community versus another puts you at higher risk, and they try to understand the characteristics of those communities that lead to this increased risk. And there is an open question about whether risk and resilience are really one side, you know, different sides of the same coin. And I think this is an issue that hasn't really been properly engaged in the literature that I know of, living in a wealthy area just the opposite side of living in a poor area? Or are there different properties which are associated with wealth and with poverty? which might have implications for response to emergencies. Now, in what follows, I want to touch upon some of the conceptual and definitional issues in studying community resilience, with a little bit of attention paid to data as well. I should say that contrary to the approach that Richard took, which is really starting from the ground up, literally, I'm looking at about 20,000 feet. And so I'm looking down on this and trying to see what one might say about community resilience, what one might say about community resilience that's relative to modeling from a social epidemiologic perspective. Now, first I have to say that the problem of community needs to be engaged. What do we mean when we say community? Do we mean communities of thought, communities of action, communities of space? Do we mean things that have continuity over time? Are they big? Are they small? This is an area which are they communities that people think about versus implicit communities? This is an important issue. I'm not going to say anything more about it. Now, in speaking of community resilience, one is reminded of both a speech by Humpty Dumpty in Through the Looking Glass and the story of the blind man and the elephant, this being one of the many versions of that story. When I use a word, Humpty Dumpty said in a rather scornful tone, it means just what I choose it to mean, and neither more nor less. And the blind man, who, as you recall, had very different views of exactly what the thing called elephant is. Now, and so it is with the term community resilience. I think we don't have a very good sense of what we're talking about. And there are plenty of other terms that we might substitute for it, some of which we've heard already. Invulnerability, robustness, stability, vitality, fault tolerance, reliabilities. We don't really know how these impact, how we measure them, and how we would substantiate them very well in a model. Now, when one does the Google search, one finds a number of definitions of community resilience. Individual and collective capacity to respond to adversity and change, such as the noise. For a community to be resilient, its members must put into practice early and effective actions so that they can respond to adversity in a healthy manner. Seems a little bit circular to me. Community resilience is the ability to thrive despite the presence of risk factors, involves the built environment, social capital, services, institutions, structural factors. Well, what else? Is that it? I could make a longer list. And community resilience training, which would presume we know what community resilience is to help communities develop the ability to recover from any disastrous event through preparation and self-reliance, and so on. Despite the rather vague and all-encompassing language, there are two features that pervade all discussions of community resilience. What's happening? All right. The first, of course, is the notion of heterogeneity of response given the same challenge. Okay, there's nothing new about this. We have the same thing happening, and we have different communities, and different outcomes are observed. So there's some heterogeneity. The second is that resilience is seen as a community characteristic. It's an attribute of the community that's more than an upward aggregation of individual characteristics. So, for example, we get a better result here, not just because there's a different distribution of people. We'll come back to both of these. And I think implied in the notion of community resilience is potentially the notion of emergence, that this is a emergent property that develops out of a complex set of social, physical, and historical processes within communities. Now, let me turn to what I think would be a social epidemiologic perspective on community resilience. This is just another way which provides a general representation of a perspective that many have where I sit. And that is that we can only understand individual and population health by reference to a multiple set of levels over time in the life course within particular environments. It's not a new notion. You've heard it already in regard to other topics. But what does it say about community resilience? Well, there we have communities, and it says that we really need kind of a bottom-up, both a bottom-up and a top-down approach if we want to understand community resilience. Now, what I want to do is to assert five things about community resilience. I only have 10 minutes, so I won't be spending much time on any of them. So these are five plus or minus assertions about community resilience that have modeling implications. I say plus or minus because I think, in fact, some of them are kind of cut from the same cloth. The first, and I'll elaborate a bit on each one of these, the threats to communities and community resilience are not independently distributed. If we want to say there's a thing called community resilience, it would be nice to think of it as something separate from what's happening to communities. The second is that the compositional element, that is the people who live in communities, reflects influences that are exogenous to those individuals, at least to some extent. The third point is that we need a life course approach to community resilience. The fourth, that community resilience needs to move away from a one-size-fits-all approach. And the last one, many of the protective resources that underlie community resilience reflect upstream processes. As you'll see, these are tied together. Let's go to the first one. So, where are we? Whoops. Okay, so here we have a wonderful Margaret Bourke White photograph from 1937 following the Louisville flood. You see, this didn't all start with Katrina. And what do we notice? It's an extraordinary picture, I think. We notice a number of things in it. But what I would say with this as the backdrop, that the social, behavioral, economic, and psychological processes that move people around often reflect real perceptions of landscapes and risks and resources. Thus, except in some, I think, smaller number of circumstances, 9/11 being one of them, you don't have the same communities undergoing the same challenges. That is, challenges and communities are not independently distributed. So the basic model of resilience as a moderating effect, except in the situations where there's a random attack, really don't apply here. So the second assertion, that compositional elements in community resilience greatly reflects influences that are exogenous. I would say in the non-modeling world, perhaps even among some modelers, composition of spatial areas is seen as springing out of the ground. Okay, and yet people move around for many reasons. So, for example, here we have a neighborhood. Now, certainly, there must be some compositional element to community resilience, but understanding it requires studies of spatial mobility and what drives it, that is, what moves people around between areas, as well as what changes areas. So, for example, if we think back to the previous slide, we see that area, the composition is heavily affected by exogenous socioeconomic forces, which lead to changes in the economic well-being of neighborhoods, which lead to changes in property values, decreases in rents, and result in population flows in which better endowed people with a whole variety of resources move in and out, resulting in increases in household poverty. So when we see an area as bereft of resources, as William Julius Wilson has shown in a number of his studies of inner city poverty and the underclass, this is the result of a process. And that process results in a community having certain resources and not having others. And so when we think of community resilience, we have to move our span of attention outside of the community to a much broader set of circumstances. So the third assertion is that we need a life course approach to our approaches to community resilience. Oh, I want to go back to the last slide for a minute. Note that if that's all true, if we have these multi-level processes happening, if they're happening over time and moving people around, then the use of hierarchical linear modeling, which has become the darling of much of the social sciences, doesn't get there at all. Well, I won't say at all. It doesn't get there. Okay. So assertion three is that just as life course approaches have become so popular in the health and social sciences, we need a life course approach to communities. Communities change. Here's a community. This is a wonderful simulation of what can happen to a community. There's one picture. Same place. Same place. Same place. And most of the attention in the world that I live in is based on compositional changes of people moving in and out, not on the forces that result in that extraordinary change in this environment. So in thinking about community resilience, if we decide how we want to think about community, when we move to resilience in terms of modeling, I think we have to think about history. I think we have to think about mobility and population flows. We have to think of the flow of resources, and people follow resources to the extent of their abilities. We have to think of the accumulation of damage and disadvantage over time from previous events, both small and large. So it's not just the big events that affect community resilience, but you can think of communities which, by dint of everyday assaults that have to do with economic disadvantage, with toxic exposures, with the decline in infrastructure, are see their resilience and capacity to respond diminished. Number four, a one-size-fits-all approach to community resilience is inadequate. We have to move away from it. First, we have to ask, of course, what is community? But notice that the appropriate spatial, socio-spatial grain, when we think about community and when we think about community resilience, has to depend on the nature of the problem we're thinking about. I'll just give you a simple example. If we're thinking about the spread of a toxic cloud, whether it's from a terrorist or industrial accident, and the resilience of a community, then that's going to spread in a much different way than if we're thinking about the spread of crack addiction in a neighborhood, which is going to be on a much smaller scale and is going to be responsive to microenvironments within that community. So the notion of community resilience has to be deconstructed into kind of an interaction between community properties, spatial properties, social properties, and the nature of the problem that we're thinking about. So I'll just end with the final assertion, and that is that protective resources that define resilience may reflect macro-level processes. Oh, I'm sorry, that was my scale picture. You know, if you've never seen The Powers of Ten by the Ames, by Roy and Charles Ames? I can't remember the first names. It's an extraordinary picture. Just making the point that scale is important. So to give you a sense of the notion of risk and protective resources and how they're influenced by macroeconomic and governmental forces, this is just a little example from some work we're doing now. Now, if you look at the 25 largest metropolitan areas in the U.S., MSAs, you find enormous variations in the total number of local governments. So, for example, Chicago has 567 local governments, each of which has their own little sphere of control, okay? And San Diego has 19. There is enormous variation in that. Now, these kinds of variations in local governments allow socioeconomic stratification spatially. And so this just shows this is from Myron Orfield's work. This shows the distribution of tax base per household capital, household per household, an average of 67,000. You see there's roughly a tenfold range. And these ranges have to do with the movements of people, but they also have to do with economic activity, with planning, and with exclusionary processes, social exclusionary processes, particularly with regard to race and socioeconomic position. In fact, they have enormous impact. And this just shows the age-adjusted mortality by the number of governments for blacks and whites, and as you in the 171 metropolitan areas with populations greater than 25,000. And you can see what happens is that governmental fragmentation is a way of differentially distributing resources, which are then relative to health, and which then get played out in the racial context, which is so strong within the U.S. And you can see that health disparities increase as the number of governments, as the number of sorting mechanisms for resources increases. Well, this is all very complicated. I've stated five assertions that suggest that community resilience is nothing that can be easily understood. And I always end with Einstein's brain and with his quote, which is that everything should be simple as it is, but not simpler. Thanks.
Okay, I'm not going to be as modest as George was. I'm an expert on community resilience. I wasn't 2 weeks ago when Richard invited me, but I Googled it since then, so I know everything there is. And I'd like to give a perspective from the perspective of formal models of resilience or some aspects of resilience, namely from network science. And the strengths and the weaknesses of network science are that they use exactly the same formal mathematical modeling tools to explain any kind of network, right? And the weakness is that, you know, community resilience seems magical. It seems unique. And that's not going to be the perspective. It resists reduction. But that's exactly what network science is going to be doing. It's going to be reducing resilience as well as everything else to nodes and the connections between those nodes. Right? And so the caveat is that we should be aware of this reduction. The advantage of this reduction is we can hopefully see that there's universal processes going on in the formation of these resilient communities. The downside is, well, I've heard a formalist defined as somebody who can't understand something unless it's made meaningless. And so that is the caveat that I'll be talking about. So from a network's perspective, one of the prominent notions of resilience is the capacity of a community to recover from damage. And what that damage is going to be loss of individuals, loss of important technologies, things that are binding people together, link structures, any of those would count as damage to the network. And as it turns out, how a network is going to rebound from the damage is going to depend on the nature of the damage, and it's going to depend upon the nature of the network structure. And so what I'm going to be talking about is not in any ways my own work, and many of you network science cognoscente know much more about the kinds of things that I'm going to be talking about than me. But here I am because I'm the expert now. So in particular, there's two different types of networks that have often been contrasted in terms of their resilience. One is a simple random network, a kind of a straw person network, in which the likelihood of any two people being connected is the same for any two people in a network. And that's oftentimes contrasted to the scale-free networks that Martina was lambasting yesterday, with good reason, but it also has to be said that there is many networks out there, such as movie-actor collaborations, sexual contacts, citations, that do follow scale-free network properties, and so that is why there's continued interest in them. They have a power law distribution of member connectivities, so the probability of a node having a given degree of connectivity is going to be proportional to that degree. And we've gotten some idea about how these networks come about, and they do come about through a very generic growth process, which takes place a lot of situations. So one way of getting them is through preferential attachment. A node that already has a large number of edges connecting it to other nodes will tend to attract still other edges. The rich get richer. Here's one particular scale-free network of the Colorado Springs high-risk sex context where each one of these lines, these blue lines that you see here, is one dyadic sexual contact. Okay. And so you can, by visual inspection, tell the difference between random and scale-free networks. The random network is on the left, and the five most connected nodes in that network are shown in red, and the five most connected nodes in the scale-free network are also shown in red here. And so, obviously, the interest of these kind of networks compared to networks where you have a Poisson or a, what you get in the random network degree of distribution is that some players, some nodes are going to be far more connected than others. So none of you is 1,000 times taller than somebody else. But there are networks out there where one node has 1,000 times the number of calls made to it, or 1,000 times the sexual contacts as another node. Right? So they're very strange from that perspective. In the random graph in this particular network that I'm showing here, the five most connected nodes are connected to 27% of all nodes, and that goes all the way up to 60% of all nodes in the case of the scale-free network. Okay, and there's two different types of attacks or ways of damaging the network that have been described by Laszlo Barabasi and his colleagues. One is targeted attacks, in which case you specifically try to disable through perhaps terrorist activities or through hackers on a computer network, you disable the most connected nodes within the network. So those most highly connected nodes are going to be disabled there, whereas in a random attack, you're just going to randomly take out some of the nodes. Right? And the result of those activities is going to result in different patterns of damaged networks. In the network on the left, with the targeted attack, we no longer have a connected network at all. It's severely fragmented. The largest connected component, as it's called in network science, is only going to be two. And we have two examples of that. Whereas if you disable the network through random attacks, then you still have a connected component here, which has got a size of 15. And that connected component is exactly what Albert and Barabasi are plotting here on the vertical axis. And what they show is that there's a strong trade-off between these networks. So if we look at random attacks, we find that the more resilient network is actually the random, I'm sorry, is actually the scale-free network down here. And we can see that you have to remove just about all of the nodes in order to no longer have appreciably sized fraction of the original network remaining. Whereas if you take out about 65%, or if you take about 65% of the nodes in the random network, then you have a very fractured network. And the reason why in this situation the scale-free network is more resilient is because your likelihood of, through random attack, getting exactly all of the hubs disabled is very rare. And so those hubs will continue to connect the network. However, the flip side of this is that if you target your attack, exactly the opposite is true. So for targeted attack, we find that the scale-free network is much more prone to disruption than even the random network. So how you disrupt the network interacts with the network structure itself in terms of resiliency. And you get exactly the same solution if the way you measure resiliency is the diameter of the network, where the diameter of the network is the average path length connecting each pair of nodes for all pair of nodes within the network. Again, we find that if you attack the network by attacking its hubs, whether it's the virtual internet, I'm sorry, I got that the wrong way, whether it's the virtual World Wide Web or the actual physical internet that it lies on top of, you get very similar results, that targeting attacks is going to drastically increase the diameter of the network as you have a higher and higher fraction of vertices removed, that's the nodes, but random failures of the networks leaves the diameter of the network relatively unchanged. Okay. And the mathematics behind a lot of this comes to us from percolation theory in physics. And percolation theory is the theory of what happens when you have a set of nodes that are arranged in what could be an arbitrary topology. What I'm showing here is a two-dimensional lattice. And the nodes within that lattice or within that topology are either occupied, there's something there, or there's something not there. And what percolation theory studies is the behavior of those networks as you change that probability of having a node there or not there. So whenever you have two nodes that are neighbors in this lattice, then you can have a link between them. Otherwise, you don't have a link. If the probability of two nodes in a lattice is below the percolation threshold, then the network will be broken into subnetworks that do not communicate with each other. And so here, the critical point of interest, I think, to resilience and community networks is the idea of a sudden phase transition, which is given by the term percolation threshold. So there's a sudden phase transition from poorly to well-connected networks. That's very much along the lines of what Ian was talking about yesterday when he was talking about the model that he has, which is actually based upon the physics model of the transition from a proper ferromagnetic to a paramagnetic at a sudden phase transition, water turning from liquid to gas at exactly 100 degrees Celsius is another example of that. Well, community networks may very well show something very similar. So if you have a connectivity that's below this critical juncture, then you will continue to be able to have a well-working community. But if all of a sudden you've disabled more units than that percolation threshold, then you will no longer have a well-connected network. And so this is important because what it means is that a community may seem like it's very well-connected in the sense that you can disable parts of it and you aren't having much appreciable, visible influence of those changes. But as soon as you cross this threshold, then you have this sudden nonlinearity and you've crossed this boundary and you can no longer go back into the situation where you can have a connected, properly network. And so even though you engage in heroic efforts to save the community, by then it's lost. Okay. Final slide on studying resilience in community models, which is what I've just been presenting, these network parables of actual communities, and also in real model communities, perhaps. In community models, what I'd like to argue, and this is what Josh Epstein was saying yesterday in some words or other, formal models are worth studying, not necessarily because they occur in pure form, not necessarily because they ever occur in pure form. They may never occur in pure form, but they're still worth studying because their essential structure is often present in real-world situations. And so understanding and identifying the statistics, the dynamics that you'd expect if you had this process in a real community is still useful, even though it's not going to apply in its direct form to any community. In perspective of model communities, how do we have best practices to establish real communities? The only thing that I would encourage is people to following up on what Elliot Smith said earlier today and many people have said over the last several days about the multi-level treatment, is to understand humans, people, as rich conceptual networks that are embedded in social networks. And so what's interesting is the individual nodes, the people, are flexible and adaptive. And this is just what Richard was saying earlier on in terms of the adaptiveness to contextual contingencies. In some ways, it's inappropriate to even consider individuals to be nodes. If you take what network science considers, you know, these structureless entities that are just transmitting information to each other, right? So individuals are adapting to each other. Richard actually had some great examples of St. Louis versus Philadelphia or Chicago during the first heat wave, during the second heat wave. That shows adaptation. That's St. Louis learning from Philadelphia's mistakes. Chicago learning from Chicago's mistakes just a couple of days earlier. And that's the kind of adaptiveness that I'm talking about. And it raises the important individual psychological question of transfer. How do we learn from one situation to apply it to another situation? And people are historically very poor at that. There's many results in cognitive psychology showing the shockingly poor ability that people have to learn a principle in one situation and then realize that it applies in another situation, even though from our enlightened perspective, it's exactly the same deep principle at work. And so that's going to be a large part of how to achieve resilience in a community is individually getting people to be able to make that transfer. So I think one view of what resilience is the product of these interactions between the individual and these inter-individual networks.
Yes, you want
to? Okay, so...
do you have a presentation?
No, I don't have a presentation. I decided to, in the interest of brevity, because I really want to get to the discussion, I would just share a few thoughts and comments, and then we can move to discussion, because of course, being interested in collective behavior, the way I think we should best solve this is by us all having our say in discussing it. So, a few thoughts that I had in relation to resilience from a biological perspective. As Richard mentioned, influenza earlier on, resilience in that particular collective system is given through the individual components, the individual agents actually not exhibiting resilience, not exhibiting robustness. The very, very high mutation rates of disease allow them to really, and also in other diseases where you have a very high turnover of cells with high mutation rates. These are different ways of making these systems inherently resilient, and that's why our own attempts at fighting these are so difficult. So that was just a thought that I had, a different angle on resilience. The other thing that sort of strikes me as a biologist is, I'm going to say something very controversial, I suppose, and I don't know if I fully really mean it, but maintaining a resilient system is pretty easy. But what you have to often do in reality is maintain a resilient system in the face of having to do other things, i.e. being sensitive to response. So, you could, for example, build a network that's exquisitely resilient, but it may not then be sensitive at picking up on external cues. And so responsiveness in the face of resilience is something that you see time and time again as a challenge to biological systems, actually trying to trade off these two factors. In the brain, you must simultaneously be able to maintain responsiveness to internal properties and internal signaling while also being able to take in information from the outside and process it accordingly. So how can a system both internally represent patterns and create patterns but also be sensitive to patterns coming in and interpret those from the outside world? So you have this issue of input selectivity, which is a challenge to different systems. And I can imagine within complex societies, you also have this challenge of input selectivity. And it's very expensive for the brain to sort of maintain itself close to a threshold response to constantly monitor things coming in. So what they tend to do is exhibit oscillatory patterns of activity, where periodically you bring yourself close to the threshold, so you have discrete periods of opportunity in which to respond to external stimuli. And remarkably, ant colonies do exactly the same thing. Contrary to popular opinion, ants are actually very lazy, as I know, at 70% of their time doing nothing, apparently sleeping. But then when they activate each other and light neurons, they can sort of activate each other, and when they're all active, they're able to distribute work more effectively. And then when the individuals are not activated by others, they can sort of fall asleep and have a brief refractory period, just like neurons. So you see these waves of activity crossing a colony every 20 minutes or so. Remaining on the ants, you also, as we saw from Gene Robinson's talk, you have this division of labor among the individuals, which allows different individuals to become more efficient at performing different tasks, so they can spatially partition tasks and also temporally partition tasks. But this can actually create decreased resilience. because, of course, if you lose one of those subsets, then you can lose the ability to actually complete a sequence of tasks that, you know, that you need to complete all parts to reach the end. And this is reminds me of Herbert Simon's thoughts on watchmakers. You know, if you have a watchmaker who just slowly makes a watch from start to finish, at any point if it's disrupted, you know, that can destroy his whole process. Whereas if he builds small components of these watches, so he has a sort of backlog, then at any moment it's disrupted, he can come back to that task and then not really be hindered in terms of time. And so social insects also do a similar thing, and they have a resilience in terms of being able to switch among tasks quite quickly. And the final sort of system that I want to sort of think about, something that I think about a lot, say within those very coordinated fish schools and bird flocks that I showed you before, they have a real challenge because they have to get rid of noise in the environment. They have to reduce the noise in the environment, but they also have to amplify weak or ambiguous stimuli. Say, take a predator, a potential predator. If they're constantly responding to anything that could be a predator, the school is expending all sorts of energy making these evasion maneuvers and can't do anything else. And also, when they're navigating, they are going up very weak environmental gradients where local noisiness, in actual fact, has to be damped. So in one condition, when you're going up these food gradients, you want to damp local fluctuations. In another situation where there's a predator, you want to amplify local fluctuations. How can you do that? And one argument, one thing that might be possible, of course, is they could sit near a phase transition between states. But in actual fact, it seems more like this contextualized adaptability is a more reasonable answer. And only very recently we've begun to understand that these organisms often have a sort of quorum response. If one fish does something, it's completely ignored. If two or three fish do something within a short time scale and it's a similar behavior, then this becomes amplified, and so you get a nonlinear threshold response. And the actual parameterization of that response we've shown by comparing to models in which they would respond in a variety of different ways is actually very close to optimal for a single parameter set, in that they maximize their accuracy while minimizing their speed. But fine-tuning parameters in advance through evolution to maximize, you know, with one set of parameters under, you know, a range of conditions is inherently difficult and likely to be, in general, far from robust. And one example then that springs to mind are how bacteria actually solve all sorts of complicated problems, including climbing chemical gradients. Bacteria can climb gradients regardless of the absolute amplitude of that gradient because they take the output of their system and feed it back in, so they can constantly compensate for overall large-scale changes, so they're always sensitive to the range that they're interested in. So I don't know whether we can take some of these ideas when we're discussing this, but I'd very much like us to be able to sort of discuss resilience now.
Yeah. Great. Thank you.
I was struck by what you just said because about the fish and the quorum sensing. There's a very comparable finding in group discussion, group decision making, that groups ignore a lone dissenter and just, you know, go about their way. You need two or three people holding a common dissenting position to get the group majority to pay any attention to them at all. That would be very interesting if that resilience mechanism, you know, against one individual error is conserved in some way between fish and humans.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And just one last point I'd like to make about that is you can, of course, this can lead to sort of informational cascades, and the fish can tend to make the wrong decision sometimes. But in general, it seems they're tuned to a point in parameter space where they will typically make the right decision. It is around two or three individuals. So.
It's the 12 angry fish.
I'd like to throw out a few ideas in terms of the modeling process. For example, in terms of the idea of a graph approach to connections between people, what struck me is that although it made a lot of sense to talk about groups and how they communicate, etc., is that it's so different from the way I model. I look at things like resources, pay a lot of attention to how resistant they have, given resources. It could be energy or a variety of other resources. And I put them in my models. And I just started thinking, since I'm not really that familiar with network analysis, et cetera, take a look at that. For example, I think it's assumed in the basic model that the threshold is constant. And I would ask, one of the questions I would ask when I'm modeling is, well, is it, you know, what? First of all, is it? I mean, in that situation you're modeling. And secondly, what are the variables? What's the dynamics of that? It might change. For example, maybe resources, an influx of resources could change that that relationship among the people. So yet at the same time, when I heard about the discrete breaking up of the network, that's really exciting to me. And what I would do is, if I were to get into this area, would be to try to look at other variables, because when you what you presented here was essentially a stimulus response, targeted attack. That's the stimulus. The response is whether or not the system would fall apart, etc. And what I would urge people to do is to fill it in with intervening variables and the context in which you're modeling.
I think that's absolutely true. And you're right that in many situations, what the main intellectual discovery that the physicists have made is the surprising constancy of these percolation thresholds, that they depend critically on the topology. For example, the pattern of connectivity, whether it's a lattice or whether there's more long-range connections, it depends critically on whether it's a two-dimensional structure or a three-dimensional structure. But one of the results is that many networks that look superficially quite dissimilar from each other would have exactly the same percolation threshold. And so that's absolutely right. The other aspect is whether I feel like the network approach will be the best way to go for resource allocation issues that you were mentioning. And my own belief is probably not. For those kind of models, I'm very attracted to the agent-based models that many people have been talking about from yesterday and today. They have this idea of mobile organisms that are figuring out where their likely resources are going to be maximized, and in the context of a lot of other organisms that are making exactly the same decisions that they are. So you get the critical notion of frequency-dependent behavior. Where I go depends upon where I see other people have already gone and where I'm also making predictions of where people will go. And so I find, my approach is always let 1,000 flowers bloom or whatever it is. So I do think the network science approach is elegant and well worth studying, but I wouldn't pursue it to the exclusion of agent-based models.
Turn the bottom. I think you turn it.
Well, it's excellent. I'm really happy to hear this discussion about thresholds and about multiple dependencies. This is my work on complex contagions is exactly to this point. The dependence of having multiple contacts affects diffusion, and specifically depends on how network topology affects diffusion dynamics, sort of contra the intuitions from small worlds and weak tides, right? And so actually relevant to your talk, I have a paper on the archive, which is coming out next week, specifically about scale-free networks. And it turns out when we're not just interested in connectivity, but interested in diffusion processes, the scale-free networks are actually far less robust. So when you perturb the cluster scale-free network, it actually breaks down much more easily than the more sort of homogeneous degree distribution. But also relevant to the first talk, I wanted to say that it put me in mind of Tolstoy in this, this quote, I forget how it goes, but all happy families are happy in the same way, but all unhappy families are. And I wondered about community resilience, where it's the same sort of intuition, where we have the same sorts of properties there when communities are resilient, but they can fail in any number of ways. And I just thought maybe we could sort of speak about that more broadly. Yeah.
I could address that to a certain extent. I mean, I think the trick with human communities is that communities not only have structural properties and they have connectivity properties and they have information diffusion systems, but they do have leadership. And I think one of the things that you see when communities are successfully resilient is it's usually characterized by you know, unique personalities and leadership qualities of people that sort of step up to the plate. And I mean, the example in St. Louis that I cited was a great example. The mayor and the public health commissioner sort of locked arms instead of fighting with each other because of, you know, competing economic interests. They locked arms and said, this is what we're going to do. And they provided, you know, direct, deliberate leadership that allowed St. Louis to do something that Philadelphia couldn't do because the business leaders were squabbling with the government officials. In Dunkirk or in Britain in 1940, generally, obviously, Churchill's, you know, truly inspiring leadership had a lot to do with maintaining the resiliency of the British public. I think that in Giuliani's leadership in New York City after the attacks of September 11th. So that there are, I think the reference to Anna Karenina is a good one. I mean, I think that when communities are resilient, they tend to rely on the same strategies. I was interested in, as I mentioned, in Rob's discussion yesterday, talking about all the different things that can line up to make communities fail at a task, and it raised very interesting questions about tuning of networks in real time. I think Ian was expressing some skepticism or some concerns that would be very difficult to do. I should say that in terms of the community mitigation guidance that we developed when we were trying to tell communities what to do if there was an H5N1 influenza pandemic, we were very deliberately adopting some ideas from percolation theory, from network theory, and thinking about how we could tune percolation systems and reduce or move the community away from the percolation threshold that would result in, you know, this widespread amplified epidemic. And I'm not sure I answered your question. I think you were asking George anyway. So
I can only engage in serious speculation here. But I am intrigued by the notion that by a couple notions. One is that from a network perspective, there must be all kinds of deformations which maintain the topology of the network, which as opposed to fracturing it, and there may be higher order properties of networks which are better, I mean, you know, which have sort of a higher modulus of elasticity than others, and that may be. Now the question is where does that come from? And so I'm trying to argue that there are these historical and macro social processes that have an impact on that. Another interesting line of thinking, I think, is the issue of diversity and the tolerance for diversity within a network. If I'm not mixing sort of metaphors too much here, but so for example, if you look at the Miller and Page book, they argue that diverse networks actually are much more efficient at problem solving and dealing with all kinds of insults. Now, what are the so that really by diversity in this setting, I would say it must mean people with varieties of resources, with varieties of perspectives, and with varieties of ability to have some impact on whatever the adaptive tasks are that need to be addressed. And I don't know how good we are at describing that, but it seems like that would be an interesting road to take.
I just wanted to warn everybody that I am on Alaska time, so I'm 4 hours behind, and it is way too early in the morning, so you will forgive my bluntness. I simply don't have the brain power to do otherwise. I don't know where to start. My name is Lil Elisa. I'm the director of the Resilience and Adaptive Management Group at the University of Alaska, and I would differ with you on many points, especially the characterization of what community resilience is. There is a large body of literature. We do understand quite a bit about community resilience, and we also characterize it in a fundamental starting point, and that is of a social ecological system. I know we're at an NIH setting, but I would caution approaching resilience from any specific network or relationships between intra-inter-individual. They're really two components. Humans, all organisms work through a biophysical environment, a social ecological system. They're emergent features and structures, embedded in each of them have different conduits, different throughputs, different eddies. It's how the two interact that leads to the kinds of thresholds that leads to whether a system is moving toward resilience or moving toward vulnerability. So there's a lot. I just don't want people to go away with the idea that resilience is, you know, a network thing. It's really very different. I also would encourage everybody to understand that what goes into our agent-based models looking at community resilience, and we model real communities who are out there, real people who are living out there, who are exposed to various risks, engage in different lifestyles, etc. It requires really a paradigm shift in the way we do science. And it requires collaborations with practitioners that really span across silos. So just a caution. And in the health and environment links, community resilience is especially important. So I would just caution us to pay particular attention to getting community resilience right in the context of health. And I won't go on. I'll leave it for somebody else.
So I think that's a great point. Hopefully, when I was prefacing my remarks about networks, I was mentioning both the strengths and the weaknesses of the network approach, because it is an idealizing approach. It is going to be throwing away a lot of the interesting details of a particular community network, and not all community networks are created equal, as George was arguing, that it's not just one thing. And yet, do I still believe that this idealization is a useful enterprise, or is it just intellectual something or other? I do believe it is still useful, because I think you can see some broad trends that will take place in many kinds of networks. And I'd be very interested as a scientist in saying what those broad trends are. So I think that there are going to be problems with treating universal laws for network resilience or community resilience, but I think that we should be striving for those, because in the process you'll be figuring out what are some of the deep structures that do promise along several different networks.
Now, don't reduce the comment. The comment is not that networks don't have a place in resilience, but understand that they're a component of resilience, and there are features of those nodes and links that are very important in human societies that come into culture. They deal with things that are much more important than we give them credit for when we reduce the system. That's the comment. I'm not saying that networks don't give us important information.
I think that's actually what I was trying to say. Not as nicely as you.
What I wanted to add to that conversation, which was very, very very useful, is thinking about at different levels of scale how what we're learning at one level of scale may be useful for another level of scale and may sort of help inform each other's perspectives from these different places. And it strikes me that community resilience has a lot of opportunities for that. One, from the vantage point of what do we understand about self-regulation, which is another area where we have a lot to learn, but the components of self-regulation in terms of some of the underlying processes that take place in terms of really being able to understand where we are, to understand what resources we can bring to bear, to understand how to build capacity for ourselves, to understand what our motives are and how to try to understand what it is at a meta level that is going on for us in terms of our emotions or in terms of our motives at an individual level sort of reflects some of the issues that take place in communities, it seems to me, and in terms of capacity building. So some of the underlying processes at a very general level, I can see a lot of similarities in terms of the, you know, why is an individual resilient, and then how is a community resilient that is composed of those individuals? And I think that's interesting to take a look at those different levels of scale.
See, let me just add one other thing. I still don't understand resilience, and I don't understand community. And I think the whole discussion is damaged. Maybe I don't think it's only my problem. I think the whole discussion is weakened by resilient with respect to what? What is it about a community that we're trying to preserve in the face of a threat? So, for example, I could think of a highly unequal society which was resilient to some sort of threats, and I could think of societies which were much more democratically and evenly organized, which were much more resilient to other threats, but they would be accomplishing different things. If you want to preserve, to say it really bluntly, if you want to preserve capital, financial capital to a threat, there are going to be different processes involved in that than in preserving human capital. So I think a lot of it depends on what it is about community that you want to be resilient. Unless that can be kind of explicated, I think we're kind of in a very messy area here.
I want to offer, as an architect, yeah, I think of the past, so offer a little bit of context on this and raise questions, really, which is important for modeling, and because that's the context here. The term resilience, as far as I know, was kind of raised to the level of buzzwordship and buzzword domain by Charles Hollings some years back, discussing the response of ecosystems to perturbations at different levels. And so in Hollings' work, which was a model, but a conceptual model and not designed for computational modeling, this leaves us with problems. And it just kind of goes back on what you just asked just a minute ago and we're talking about, is that after some kinds of perturbations, an ecological community will recover and rebuild itself like it was before in the same distribution of different species and, you know, spatial organization and things. And under other kinds of perturbations, in part because of the nature of the ecosystem itself, its status, after a perturbation, it will rebuild, but not in the same way, in something very, very, in some way that's very, very different. And so in terms of our modeling of this, we need to differentiate between those two different kinds of recovery in resilience, and we need to be able to define what is being maintained, what is being recovered, and we have to define this in order to model it. It's easy to talk about community resilience and recovery and things like that, but we, in order to do this computationally, as Hollings never did, we do need to kind of define it. That's the question: is what do we want to know? What do we want to model? What kinds of things do we want to maintain? What kind of recovery do we want to talk about? So that's.
Okay, no. So I wanted to return to network resilience and just mention that computer scientists have, to some extent, dismissed the internet as being vulnerable to targeted attack, because any topology that you see is there because the routers are routing in a particular way. As soon as one router goes down, it'll just get routed around. Similarly, as anyone who has posted some content on the web that they didn't want to be there anymore, they've probably discovered that it's really hard to remove because that content will be replicated, there will be new links formed to the new locations. And so I would say that actually both systems are remarkably resilient and would even be resilient to targeted attack. And so I wanted to ask, to what extent then could, and this is complete speculation, that if, when you look at communities of lower socioeconomic conditions, is there lack of resilience or worse health outcomes? How is that, to what extent is that tied to their inability to, say, form these networks or have flexibility in networks such as, you know, in many other systems you might observe?
Well, if you look at the literature on social capital, which is another one of these buzzwords that's been terribly misused, you find that there's this bridging, bonding, and linking forms of social capital that people talk about now. And so if you have a community which is very well connected, let's say an ethnic enclave, which is very well connected within itself but has no links to across into other communities, then to the extent that it's resource limited, it's not going to be able to withstand threat very well. But if you have these bridging and linking sorts of connections, then that gives it additional resources, finding jobs, finding food, finding housing, a whole variety of other things. So so I think you're raising an interesting question, but it depends. So the resources, so in answer to your question, I guess the if communities have these three forms of social capital, I would guess they're more likely to be able to withstand these kinds of threats than if they don't.
So I think it's been an interesting open-ended discussion that hopefully will carry on into lunch for those of you who are lingering around. I'd like to just ask, I'd like to thank Irene for organizing the session. And Jeremy, obviously, as well, for being our host. And Irene, we should thank your supporting staff who did a lot of the legwork, but I don't know who they are, so if you would like to point them out.
I will. A meeting like this doesn't get put together without really incredible support staff. And again, I'd like to thank Jen Villani, who's just walking back there, and Monica Volcaner, who is out in the hallway. And they've been extraordinary. I want to have some take-home messages. Jeremy is sitting here, and we'll be listening carefully, and I will. What I'd like to do is just pass this microphone around from one person to another and have each person just say one thing, either what you learned at this meeting that was important or what you would like to see as a next step. Okay?
Well, it's been interesting to see the diversity of modeling approaches and efforts across the areas that I'm much less familiar with, and as well as ones I am familiar with. What I would like to see out of this is a broader appreciation for the potential power of a complex systems approach in general, systems to both human biology, epidemiology, health, and social behavior, and a recognition that some of the approaches promoted here today probably should be not so experimental, but used much more widely across social sciences and maybe across natural sciences also.
Not that you didn't do this, Michael, but also we have about a half hour, so well, be brief.
I guess the main thing I learned is I didn't know many of the people that were giving papers at this talk, and I was amazed at how much overlap there was in a lot of the research and a lot of things that people do in very different arenas can really learn from each other and start having more cross-disciplinary communication.
I guess in some ways I'm just reiterating some of the things that I've heard already, which is I've been impressed with the breadth of the speakers here today, and was really enjoyed seeing the variety of different approaches and the different disciplines that people are coming from, and that it's not a standard social science conference, which I enjoy very much going to, but also having people come from disciplines that I'm not usually involved with.
I guess I would say I feel as though the social science side of it got a little short shrift here. There was a lot strong focus, I think, on individual from kind of genetic up, but there's this missing link, which isn't to say it was gone, it was missing completely, but I think there's an enormous amount of very, very good work that's being done that could inform the discussion here that wasn't represented. A lot of it that I'm familiar with is going on at the Santa Fe Institute now, particularly in the behavioral science program that they have there. So I'd really encourage the next steps to sort of tap into that.
So, I tend to agree a little bit with what I've just heard now. See, I have to admit, me, I'm from Carnegie Mellon, and I thought a lot about Herb Simon during this talk. And I mean, Herb by himself would have been typically the kind of guy trying to translate these attempts to kind of characterize abstractly it's my choice of words, I'm sorry, this concept, like this morning, for example, about race, racism, exactly, from into mathematical modeling. And he had this sense that ultimately you understand what you're doing when you can do a mathematical model of it. And I appreciate the fact that there was an attempt at that. I tend to be, like Martin, a bit frustrated nevertheless, because the interdisciplinarity here sometimes left to kind of face a bit of different places. But I have to say, I came out of here with a few inspirational talks, nevertheless, in the process. I would say, for example, Ian Cousins, I'd managed to capture my imagination bizarrely different ways, as well as did Nathan in a different way, you see, and you know, many of the people as well as the guy from the banking system. So the inspiration comes from all sorts of places. So in other words, I thought it was a big success. And I do believe that this kind of interdisciplinarity, even if it leads to inducing critic outcome, one can criticize a bit things, it fundamentally is very good.
I was interested to see that an awful lot of people here aren't supported by NIH. And I hope that one of the take-home messages will be that NIAID and NIGMS and maybe with other offices, OBSSR, can work together to help support some of these extraordinary scientists and use some of these powerful tools to help improve health.
Well, I learned a tremendous amount, more than I probably can process. I think moving forward, I would like to see how this could be formally incorporated into programs at NIH and involving some of these scientists in helping us to better, helping program staff to better understand these methods and how to bring social science and mathematical modeling together to refine our moving the science forward in the behavioral science areas.
Kia ora koutou, my name's Andy Kliske, University of Alaska Anchorage, also at the Resilience and Adaptive Management Group. I'd certainly reiterate the comments that others have made about the value and importance of the diversity of approaches and backgrounds that we've had at this very short workshop. I've not really been exposed to much in the area of health and epidemiology, and that's been interesting for me. I guess one point I would make, I do work in Alaskan rural villages where we're looking at community response, adaptation and resilience to environmental change. I've been working there for 5 years, and I guess I would just add the usefulness of taking bottom-up approaches as well as some of the broad, overarching, more theoretical and structured approaches that have been presented here. I think there's, you know, again, on this theme of diversity of approaches, suggest that there is a lot we can understand to fill in some of the gaps with understanding modelling approaches by actually working with people in the, if it's human communities that we're modelling and trying to understand, by not only doing that sort of ethnographic on the ground approach, but taking the model approach, modelling outputs and results, and taking those two people, you'd be surprised at the ability of people in the community to understand our results if we package them properly.
So I was in Bethesda last week for another meeting associated with complex system stuff, and eating in a restaurant, I ran into a branch chief from an unidentified NIH institute. And he said, what are you doing here, George? And I said, well, I'm here for this complex systems thing. He said, oh, there's nothing there. It's rubbish. And I'm sure all of you have experienced some of that. This is still a scientifically a marginalized area, and I think meetings like this help to establish this broad interdisciplinary tent, which will provide the social capital and human capital to move things forward. So it's been tremendous that for me to be here. I think the ultimate challenge, which I still see, is how one deals with all this this huge range of phenomena that we've discussed within this KISS framework. It seems like everybody struggles with that. And I'm going to be at a Keck meeting next week dealing with complexity ranging from molecular to biosustainability issues. So I suspect it's even a bigger issue there. But it does seem that the real challenge to modeling, and I know many of you are more experienced than I am in this, is hanging on to the richness of the phenomena we're interested in while being able to implement it in a KISS-like way.
I want to thank Irene and Jeremy for the meeting. I think this has been like having a delicious appetizer. I'm hungry for more. And I think there's two things I'd like to see come up. One is I know I'd like to dig down into the details of modeling implementation in specific areas. Pick your area. I think there's two things I'd like to see come up. One is to be able to dig down into the details of implementing models to address specific problems across levels of analysis. I think we've heard the interest in that. I think, you know, we've heard the modelers say, give us more to tell. And I think, not being a modeler, I would like to actually engage in that kind of conversation. And I think that can come out of such a meeting. The second thing I've heard here, though, is the need for training in modeling. Modeling is really very diverse, and it's not readily available to a lot of different disciplines. And to the extent that we could have training, especially that featured going across levels of analysis, I think we'd see perhaps a faster advancement in this program.
I can very much second that. This has been very intellectually stimulating. I'm very grateful, and I am very much a researcher in need. Because I'm a clinical psychologist, I work in the community, I actually work facilitating collaboration between clinicians and clergy, and what that means at the community level. We've had a lot of success at it, and I've published my model of that, not from the way you guys mean it. I mean, I've, you know, made arrows. And therefore, I very much need to know the steps to take, if not to get the actual training, because I've read the literature, and it's like a second career, as well as many of you know. I'm very interested in how I can quantify what I've enacted, and I'm getting requests to enact more, and I want to quantify it.
I was struck by the emphasis on dynamical processes and how well they fit into a systems model approach. And I think that's going to serve the development of this initiative very well. And I'd like to echo the earlier comments about seeing this grow as a program across NIH.
I generally work with social science demographers and sociologists, and I'm a psychologist, so that was difficult for me. I got attracted to doing this kind of modeling recently, and the hardest thing I have to deal with is talking to my colleagues who use a model. They use regression models and correlational techniques, and they draw boxes and arrows. And they don't. It's hard for me to convince them why we should be approaching this in a different way. I mean, they kind of understand what I'm talking about, but what I think we need for the field to push this forward is some papers that really illustrate well what you miss by doing regression and correlational techniques. And I think that's something that would help trying to push this and demarginalize this type of work, in at least in public health where I work. So,
I want to echo what was said earlier about we need more of you folks applying for grants at NIH. Well, that's we program directors, that's our job to worry about how to help you get in. But there is a small cabal of us already that are working on this. We have an R21 PA that's published looking at system science, which is another way of looking at saying dynamic models. I would have preferred that term. I was just absolutely blown away by everything that was said here today. I think it's wonderful stuff, and I certainly encourage you to contact some of us at NIH if you have any interest in getting into health. I do addiction.
I would just like there to be a sort of a matchmaking service for the modelers to get together with the people with data, the empiricists and the people with large-scale data sets. If NIH in some way could be involved in that matchmaking effort, it would be great.
So I already sit in a very interdisciplinary school, a school of information. However, I don't usually hang out with people who study biological systems. And so this was very exciting and encouraging that you had this correspondence between empirical observations and agent-based and analytical models. And I'm looking forward to introducing more of that into my own work to complement some of the empirical online studies I've been doing.
I'm also with an NIH institute and a division of treatment and recovery research on alcohol and alcoholism, alcohol use, alcoholism. I got so many ideas from the formal modeling, the potential of that, the network modeling, computational. These are areas I'm not familiar with. Our grantees have not been submitting grants that utilize any of those sort of exploratory tools, and just recovery research, relapse research, binge drinking, those are all still enigmas in terms of understanding how they work. We've got tons of data, but those underlying dynamic principles have not yet been discovered. And I think, you know, there's just huge potential for that here. So I'm hoping you can use the listserv to give us some, you know, basic readings that would inform people like us who want to be bridges, you know, between scientists, because there are scientists that I know that I think would love to work with these people.
Like others have said, I was very amazed by the diversity of the approaches and also the topics. And just to second someone earlier, I think maybe the next thing is to be exposed to more or a higher level of detail.
Hi, I'm a modeler, and I would like to see more about the implementation of these ideas, how certain demographics or cultural traits affect social behavior. I would really like to see my agents replicate reality, because I work with agent-based models, and they're all they're not replicating reality right now. And just when I hear all these wonderful things about what people do, I would really like us to take that and put it into our models. So that's what I would like to see.
As a science writer at the National Institutes of Health, I'm looking forward to writing about this field, and I'm hoping that at some point in the near future, instead of just models, we have some very interesting results and stories that I can tell.
I enjoyed the meeting. I want to reiterate the point I made before, that I think it would be useful to start building the mathematical formalizations for many of the discussions we had before. I think there are very interesting mathematical counterparts to the discussion that went on, and I think it would be useful to take that step as we go along.
Yes, hello. I'm Stephen Marcus of the National Cancer Institute. We've been working on applying systems methods to several behaviors, including tobacco control, for about 6 or 7 years now. And we've got a publication on the topic that may be useful to many of you. I have a couple comments. The first one is along the lines of matchmaking. I work in the largest behavioral research program at all of NIH, at the National Cancer Institute. And so there's a greater wealth of talent there than you will find. There are many institutes at NIH that do not have a single behavioral scientist. You know, we've got dozens and dozens. So please give us a call. The second comment is the importance of a broad definition of environment. in some settings, environment is interstitial fluid. In another environment, in another setting, environment might be the family. I would argue, and most of the work that we've done, we take very seriously the policy environment, the media environment, the very largest levels, and the importance of looking at all the multiple levels and the interactions between them. And finally, we held a series of workshops in the last couple of years looking at the importance of model docking, that the inputs of one model should, the outputs of one model could become the inputs to another. And no one approach is going to give you all of the answers, and so the importance of bringing people together from different traditions and basically trying to figure out how to integrate the results of the models, I think, is really critical. Thank you.
I'm a graduate student just getting started in the field of behavioral modeling, so I'm coming away with quite a few tools. And a lot to go look up when I get home. And actually, just the opposite of what Josh says, I'm feeling quite reassured that I'm getting into the right field, because even the things that may not be applicable to my research I found, by and large, quite fascinating. So.
See, what have I learned? What haven't I learned? Though I know nothing. I know even less than I knew when I walked in the door the first time. I think, again, this reinforced a learning curve I have, that we're at the beginning of a paradigm shift in the way we practice science. We're at the beginning of a paradigm shift, and it's a very important thing to pay attention to. So as much as we pay attention to the science, we do, we need to be very vigilant and very strategic about this paradigm shift itself. That's ourselves. That is part of the complex system that we are part of, we the practitioners. And the next steps that I would like to see is somehow better communication. How we do that is another question, but better communication so that we can match people up, so that we can share approaches.
I'm very glad to have followed Lil. That was very nice. I'm Deborah Winslow, and I'm Program Director for Cultural Anthropology at the National Science Foundation. And I started there 3 years ago after 27 years as a university professor. Cultural anthropology is the lowest budgeted program in the lowest budgeted division in the lowest budgeted directorate at the National Science Foundation, the social and behavioral and economic sciences. At the same time, when I came, it had had the same program director for 20 years, and I thought there might be an opportunity to do something slightly different. And just about that time, Steve Lansing knocked on my door and said, "Hello, I'm Steve Lansing, and here's what anthropology should be doing." And he convinced me, and I went off to the British Antarctic Survey for a week-long workshop, which was lovely because it was in Cambridge, but it was entirely in differential equations by physicists. And on day three, somebody told me that my interests were really sociophysics and they could explain everything. I was not completely convinced. Anthropology is inherently interdisciplinary, but it's always brought these disciplines to a very small focus. And to my mind, anthropology's big problem has been scaling up. So is to make it interscalar, and I think this is the way we're going to end up going. It's also very expensive to do this. Models are expensive to build, computer time's expensive, modelers cost a lot when they come into proposals anyway. So what I would like to see happen is some way of sharing models, of sharing training, of my scientist being able to directly benefit from the work that other people are doing and work together with people to solve the problems. We're really good at case studies and how things fit together at the local level, and we can learn a lot from this larger perspective. Thank you.
I'm Josh Epstein, and I direct the Center on Social and Economic Dynamics at Brookings, and I'm a external professor at the Santa Fe Institute, and I enjoyed many of the presentations. I thought they were fantastic, and met many new scientists who I look forward to collaborating with. I guess I'm with Martina, I think. On the one thing that I'm not there yet, and as a next step, what I'd like to do is, you know, collaborate with whomever would be interested in developing a really clean, simple example of a model, you know, in which the individual neurobiology and psychology is right, you know, supportable, credible, scientifically sound, that you take a bunch of these scientifically credible individuals and you put them in a social interaction setting that is also credible and sound, and that their interaction generates some macroscopic social pattern that can be compared to data and found to match it. And I don't care what the data is about particularly. It could be a migration pattern or epidemics or settlement pattern or wealth distribution. I don't much care, but I can sort of taste these two. There's a lot of work on the social level, and there's fascinating work of which I was not aware on this neurobiological level, but I'm itching to put them together in a model that will go from the, you know, from neurons to some social measurable, comparable to data regularity. And I'd like to collaborate with people in building a simple, clean one of those.
I'm Stephen Eubank, and I'm a representative of the physicists who always get looked at. Yes. So, one of the things that I learned here was that the next step is a much bigger step than I had thought it might be. I was sort of hoping to come here and find the information that would let me flesh out the small scale parts of the models that I build, so the individual, make the individuals look more reasonable. But I think before I can do that, I really have to understand what it is that constitutes explanation and modeling in sociology and in neurobiology, because it looks very foreign to me. It's not something that I recognize as mathematized in such a way that I could use in my models. And I need to figure out how to bridge that gap.
Thanks. My name is David Lounsbury, and I'm a community psychologist working at a comprehensive cancer center, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. And I really appreciated the breadth of discussion about biological all the way through sociological approaches to thinking about health. And I think that in terms of my own work, which is really studying and modeling community-based systems of care, and I've been using a system dynamics approach to kind of like do that modeling, it would be a good next step to think about interdisciplinary approaches to looking at these issues, as well as participatory approaches, really involving members of the community in making sense of some of the constructs that we've been talking about. I really enjoyed our discussion this morning about race and culture and ethnicity, and really trying to make sense of that and fit that into the work that we've been doing.
I'm Steve Frank. I'm a biologist who's been making mathematical and computer models for about 30 years. And biologists often come to me, cancer biologists, infectious disease biologists, and they say, Steve, I have this problem. Can you make a model? And I always say, yes, it's easy. Making models is easy. And I think that there was a lot of emphasis on the value of models and the different methods. And of course, one has to learn those things. If you're going to make models, you have to have various methods and tools. But to me, there's only really one problem in modeling, and that's what's the question. And I was struggling quite a bit. I'm an outsider. I'm not a social scientist. And somebody might ask me, what did you learn? I said, well, I learned that I don't know what the question is. So as a take-home, really what I would like to see, maybe this could happen after the meeting because things aren't necessarily over here. Everybody's emphasized how much they would like to get money, but getting money is going to depend on convincing people that this is a valuable thing to do. And one thing we could do as an exercise is come up with 10 questions, well-defined questions, puzzles that really need to be solved. And a good question isn't just something that, oh, here's something that's interesting. Really, the key to modeling is always asking the right question. Right? And asking a good question in modeling is that there's a puzzle. Everybody can agree that the observations occur, that the phenomenon occurs, that we don't understand it, that we need to understand it, that it's an important problem. What's the definition of an important problem? It's a problem that touches on lots of other things. Often it has deep conceptual issues and it has important practical issues. And it's probably not hard. Everybody probably has in their mind, who's a social scientist, what they think the puzzles are. But leaving this meeting, I have no idea what those are. And so just, you know, everybody's very positive. I'm going to take the negative role. I'm kind of disappointed. I would have liked to have walked away saying, well, I can at least think of three or four really clearly defined puzzles that I understand about social science, that if I decided I wanted to use the tools which I've developed in 30 years of biological modeling to apply to social science, I would at least know where to go, because that's the issue, right? I have the tools. I can make models. I can make models of anything, more or less. It's not that hard. So as an outcome, I would like to see 10 puzzles or questions. And it isn't as easy as it sounds. You can't just write down 10 things you think are interesting. You have to write down, again, they have to be problems that are solvable. They have to be at the right level. They have to be something that everybody can agree on the observations. This is an interesting problem. And so I think this is something that we could do that could possibly lead to what many people say they want, which is for NIH to take this seriously. Because I was on the committee that was originally put together to ask whether this is something NIH should take seriously. And I'm ambiguous at this point. I wasn't really convinced very heavily by that. I mean, I know that modeling exists and the techniques exist, but I already knew that. And so I think these are things that still could be done. I think the expertise is here. I just don't think it necessarily came out perhaps as much as it might have.
I actually changed seats. So I just wanted to get it back. I'm Georgi Babashov, and I'm a modeler at RTI International. And I have two interests, essentially. One is taking the models and some theoretical concepts that have been developed and figure out how they could be actually applicable to real policy questions. And it's a little bit chimes in with what Stephen has said, but in many ways, we're trying to work with anthropologists and with ethnographers and build models of behavior in application to a particular policy question. And so this is one part that we've been working on. And another part is more technical, is I'm trying to figure out a clear distinction between modeling artifacts. So when we observe certain phenomena, certain results of our models, we just want to know whether what we observe, what we see through simulations, whether it's something real or this is because we put the model this way and we could see it without using the model. And so more rigorous analysis is that what I'm interested in. So I'm kind of like in between two groups. So yes, I really would like to have more discussion about particular policy questions that we can answer, and also work more with statisticians and mathematicians to actually get more rigorous analysis of agent-based models. And if anybody is interested, we're actually setting up a workshop at Duke, and it's sponsored by National Institute of Statistical Sciences. Actually, it's a little bit short notice. It's end of November, November 20th and 21st, where we actually get together and discuss statistical issues in agent-based models.
I think a big theme has been the potential role of models as a meeting ground for different disciplinary focuses, different levels of analysis. And I think that's really a tremendous promise. And I think we've understood that multiple levels are relevant. But really, to cash that out, we need some of the things that that Josh mentioned, that Rob Goldstone mentioned, matchmaking. We need to find collaborators from other disciplines who share, you know, an interest in modeling and have that disciplinary expertise that we ourselves don't have. And then we need kind of what's the next step after that, because an interdisciplinary team that gets put together and, you know, talks for a few days isn't in a position to write a $500,000 grant proposal. We need something, a smaller step along the way. You know, are there ways that $25,000 or $50,000 worth of funding could be used to put together workshops or training sessions to help get our graduate students up to speed and these kinds of things to build the teams that can then write the grants?
I'd like to add to that. And one of the things that I see is that yes, there's an emerging community. And one of the issues, getting back to our discussion of communities, is how to capacity build. And if I think about the development of computational biology, you know, one issue is how does your knowledge of how that developed inform what it is that we can do? And so when I look at that and I look at documents historically in terms of, well, how did this happen? How did this community get together? I mean, I remember 25 years ago, talking to colleagues in biology when we, you know, they were really puzzled by an ANOVA. I mean, this was a very different world. And so how did it ramp up so fast? And remember, we're still young. And so maybe the expectations for us are a little different, and maybe we need some scaffolding. And we need, you know, we can't come into this at a level of sophistication that biology is at 25 years later, you know. So that's just my thought on that front. But also, I've learned a lot from this meeting and the need to sort of think about these models across fields and the need for training. Training not just across domains. I agree that a common puzzle across domains would be interesting. But also, the other part of it is we're kind of the mavericks in our own domains, right? And so part of it is to build capacity back to our fields. You know, how do we help people get on board to build the capacity to be able to do more? What do we do? I mean, training grants are great, but having like postdocs or, you know, faculty, visiting faculty, some things like this, I think would also be great.
Yeah, I would just like to reinforce what Lynn and Elliot have said, and also John Cassioppo mentioned the need for training, small-scale meetings, workshops, things like that. The one other thing I would like to mention, obviously some of it comes out of my own biases, but I think there's clearly a need to better develop individual-level social modeling and also then to focus on how these individual-level models can be integrated into group-level models, societal-level models. I know from talking to some of the people doing agent-based models, most agent-based modeling systems use very simple models of the person, and I think we need to be able to have better models and also to explore what aspects of those models actually matter when you move up levels of scale and what aspects of those models maybe can be sort of abstracted out when you want to look at sort of group or societal level behavior.
I'm going to reiterate a few things. It's hard when you're at the end of such a diverse group to say anything novel. But I mean, reiterating on training, undergraduates don't know what disciplines are. They don't know what boundaries are. And I really think we have to start there and start really teaching interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary courses before people even know what disciplines are, because honestly it will sneak up on them and before you know it you'll have a very well-trained population of people. In terms of the modeling, I think I was a little concerned by some of the modeling in that it was hard for me to see how it was actually being done, and it's very easy in a model to put complexity in and just add and add more things, but then, of course, a model doesn't really give you predictive power because it can, you know, if you're clever enough, you can put anything. I can't remember who said it, but, you know, give me 2 free parameters, I'll give you an elephant, give me 3 and I'll make it wiggle its trunk. You know, this is a kind of a danger, I think, with this type of modeling. So, again, some sort of, someone mentioned earlier, some people with training with rigorous approaches and so on could be extremely useful, and what I think is going to be a massively blossoming area. You know, if we get this right, I think this could be a transformative area of research.
I really, being the last, can't add anything to what's said. I'm a medical oncologist by training, and my day job is directing a program to develop drugs to treat people who've been exposed to high doses of radiation. So my concluding comment is that it was really, really fun to be in a room with a lot of smart people who are working on things that have nothing to do with what I think about on a day-to-day basis.
So let me first off by thanking everybody. From my perspective, this has really been a very interesting and engaging start to a continuing discussion. I'm struck by several things which came up. One is sort of the interplay between diversity and universality. You know, on the one hand, this is a diverse group of people coming from lots of different disciplines who said things that I'd never heard before, and you know, I think said things that a lot of people in the room hadn't heard before. On the universality front, though, I think almost every aspect of what NIGMS supports is going through the same transition from individual-based analysis to systems-based analysis, and is having the same conversation with completely different jargon, but the same conversation about how you integrate. You know, what level of detail do you need to include in molecules if you're going to try to model a cell? Same discussion. I mean, the mathematical, statistical issues about how you know what you've done. You know, does it matter if your molecules are all rigid or dynamic? There's the same discussions. But it's clear, I think, in all fields that this is where science has to move, because most interesting phenomena take place at the systems level, and understanding the pieces in infinite detail and never putting them together doesn't get you very far. In terms of take-home messages, I think, you know, you've heard from a number of folks around NIH. There's a lot of interest at low levels, I think, across many of the institutes and centers, and that's one thing that OBSSR and, you know, we're certainly glad to take a lead in trying to bring some of this stuff together, but there's going to be tremendous robustness and resilience in having this be an NIH-wide effort rather than being a pocket in one institute or another. Secondly, with, you know, following up on that, you know, the program directors across NIH really like hearing from people. I mean, you know, we're from the government, we're here to help. But I think you can learn, you can get a lot by contacting the folks who are here, or and just, you know, saying, here's what I'm interested in doing. I'd like to organize a meeting with the following people, and just getting some guidance about how to approach NIH in an effective, mutually beneficial, hopefully non-frustrating sort of circumstance, rather than not contacting people and sort of throwing something over the threshold and having people not be expecting it, not know what to do with it. So contact me, contact the program directors, ask questions, and let's all work together moving forward. You know, obviously the NIH budget has been more constrained than usual over the last few years, and we're, you know, my major day job is resource allocation decisions, but I think, you know, there's been a lot of progress made. I think the case to be made for how important and exciting the science is really coming together, and that will serve you all and this whole community well as things move forward. You know, and we'll do what we can to make it easier, but in the end of the day, it's the science that's going to drive the decision making, and I think, you know, this field broadly defined is in a very strong position to make a very strong case. But there's lots to do. So, yes, we can.
And I think I heard a lot of it really interesting sparks, and I would at this point kind of turn it over to you as the seeds in a community, and just urge you to keep building this community and keep in touch with us. I don't have anything else to say, so thank you for coming, and we'll be in touch.